We're back on golf today. The PGA Tour, Century Insurance, and the Century Club of San Diego today announced that Century will assume its title sponsorship of the PGA Tour's longstanding event at Torrey Pines in San Diego to be renamed the Century. Set to return to iconic Torrey for the 60th time as the kickoff to the PGA Tour's network debut on CBS, it will begin Monday, January 25th of next year and conclude on January 30th with a Saturday finish. And this from PGA Tour CEO Brian Rolapp. For 75 years, the PGA Tour has hosted elite competition in San Diego, including the last 60 at Revere Torrey Pines. And we are proud to build upon that legacy and longtime philanthropic impact with our partners at Century Insurance. We are pleased to have the support of Century and the Century Club of San Diego to further grow what fans and players have long recognized as one of our game's most celebrated venues and events. Time now for another Golf Today roundtable as we welcome in GolfChannel.com senior writer Ryan Lavner and Brendan Porath, co-host of the Shotgun Start podcast. Lav, I want to start with you. I was here doing Golf Central over the weekend watching Russell Henley birdie his way to the house and adding one more in a playoff. How much street cred does this Georgia Bulldog have? Went to your school, in your mind?
A lot of it, Damon. And it was certainly impressive what he did on Sunday, birding the last four holes to practically steal the golf tournament from Eric Cole. And when we look at the resume that Russell Henley has now compiled over the course of his career, added a signature event to his resume last year at Bay Hill, now winning a Colonial, one of the most revered venues on the PGA Tour, knocked off some Ryder Cup experience in addition to his President's Cup experience back in 2024. So he has a very complete resume at this point. The only thing missing at the age of 37 is a major championship. And he sort of sniffed contention, been in contention at the U.S. Open. I think this year's venue at Shinnecock makes a lot of sense as well. Finished just a couple shots shy of Rory McIlroy at the Masters just 2 months ago as well. So there's still time. He's 37. But you would think with his skill set, the opportunities will probably be dwindling over the next couple of years. But I certainly think he has the game to capitalize right now.
Brendan, Eric Cole lost the playoff yesterday, and it was noticeable in his press remarks afterwards in his media conference. Every question he received was put to him by a member of the PGA Tour's communications team. And this the same weekend that SI laid off its entire golf team and is getting out of the golf coverage business, it seems. Should that bother golf fans out there, or do you think they would even notice at this point?
It should. They may not notice. You may be right. They may not notice it as much as an eagle-eyed viewer like yourself or me listening to the post-game remarks. But it should bother them. It should bother the tour, too, probably. I think Brian Rolapp, and we just showed his statement in regards to the San Diego event, is a pretty sharp executive and understands it's simple. But he keeps it simple, right? He's smart, but he understands it's very simple that fans need texture. They need storytelling. They need some context around these personalities. And I think with fewer people out there covering the game, what is this era of storytelling going to look like? When we, you know, Sports Illustrated now has laid off their golf staff. It's one of the great resources, though it's harder to find given a lot of their archives have been lost. It's one of the great resources in looking back at prior eras, right, through their vault and on all the great writing from Jaime Diaz and others, that Michael Bamberger, who are still out there doing it. How will we know this era? Who's out there? If it's just tour employees asking a few questions, it's still a service. But how will we come to know this era? Is it going to be by, you know, betting slips or the cross tabs of a strokes gained spreadsheet? Like, I think it's a real concern if you're someone, the tour, its fans, trying to understand the players. And Brian Rolapp and the tour have always struggled with how do we promote the players outside those top four or five. How do we get these stories in the middle that are exceptional players and have some great backstories told in a more relatable way? And I think the fewer people you see out there covering the game, and it's not just a rank and file event issue. We've seen this and heard about it at playoffs events, right? Where the media kind of clears out as the week goes along and the stories of those tournaments are lost a little bit. So I think it is a concerning issue both for the tour and certainly the consumer.
Brendan, you've opened up a vein. So Lav, I want to come back to you on a similar topic. How has your own journalistic journey kind of shifted from when you started working
at Golf Channel. Is there still a place for you to write the 3,000-word story, the profile? Are there people out there that even can consume or want to read a 3,000-word piece or feature on a player anymore?
I sure hope so, since I'm working on a J.J. Spawn piece that's going to drop in a couple weeks on golfchannel.com in advance of his U.S. Open title defense. But to Brendan's point, I think it's certainly concerning for the PGA Tour. Keep in mind, Fort Worth is now a top 10 media market as well. You used to have the Dallas Morning News, the Star Telegram. I mean, these were some heavyweights in the business in terms of sports media coverage. If they're not up there covering the Charles Schwab Challenge at what is, again, a pretty light time on the sports calendar. I know some of those reporters may be pulled in a direction with the San Antonio Spurs making the NBA Finals, but that certainly has to be concerning. And it's look, this is Brian Rolup, who comes from the NFL. He understands the power of big media, national media, making sure these athletes are presentable to the general public. That's how you're growing the audience. We already have established golf viewers. They're watching Golf Channel. They're watching shows like Golf Today. It's how do you appeal to mass audiences? And Russell Henley would be a perfect example of that. Now, a six-time winner on the PGA Tour. He's played major championships. He's played on National Cup teams. Does anyone really know anything about him other than his artist wife, the fact that he went to Georgia? He was a prolific amateur and college winner, and now he has won again on the PGA Tour. To me, it's a function of the PGA Tour and trying to make these tournaments as accessible as possible to not just national media, but local media as well.
Brendan, Bryson was, of course, making some curious news again at the weekend. He said he used AI to fix his swing at the LIV tournament out in Korea. And it's 11 years ago today since he won the NCAA title. And later that summer, Lav got one of the all-time quotes about Bryson from a college coach at the U.S. Amateur who said that he was destined to end up in one of two places. He was either going to be world number one or in a straitjacket. Which one do you think he's closer to at this point of his career?
I mean, talk about the texture of adding to a character. There you go, Lavender, Gumshoe reporting, a quote we're still calling on 10 years on. You know, this seems wildly unsurprising to hear Bryson, you know, citing conversations with Gemini and AI tools. I think, you know, what Bryson has always needed is something to completely latch onto, even if it lacked some substance or some foundation in reality. He needs something. And maybe his good friend Gemini is now what will kind of consume his focus for better, often for better in Bryson's case, whether it's the bulking season, or it's just this maniacal focus on equipment. Maybe it's buddying up with Gemini as his swing coach. Honestly, if this maniacal focus could help him, even if it lacks in some real substance or underlying real foundation.
Yeah, I don't put too much stock into the AI shout out. Keep in mind, Bryson does have a partnership with Google Cloud, so he might just be being a good salesman in this respect. To bring that up, Eamon, I think is really interesting because that was such a fun time to cover the sport back in 2015 when Bryson was making a name for himself, won the NCAAs, won the U.S. Amateur over the span of a couple months. Like, this was a singular talent who was approaching the game so differently. And there was a lot of thought at the time that he is going to be a transformational figure from an equipment perspective. And that really hasn't panned out over the past 11 years when you're talking about the single-length irons or floating his golf balls in Epsom salt. He's got the 3D printed irons. He's got the bulge and roll face on the driver. He's most likely going to be coming out with his own line of golf balls here over the next couple of years. There has not been a revolution yet on that front, which was promised from Bryson DeChambeau. Maybe AI is the next frontier for Bryson and trying to hit sort of a mass movement that way. It certainly couldn't hurt, Eamon. You and I both are suffering and afflicted with the driver yips. I've never tried ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini, but perhaps that's a road that you and I both need to go down.
Oh, I can't blame the teacher. I'm really not in unless I have someone physically to blame for that.
Well, I want you to break out your crystal ball, Brendan. Let's keep talking about Bryson. January 2027, is he going to be playing on the PGA Tour? A shrunken LIV golf tour, or just hitting flop shots in his backyard? What's most likely in your mind?
I think he'll probably be making YouTube videos with Gemini, right? consulting on the games and swings. I January 2027 feels a little soon. I know he is certainly an asset to professional golf. Whether he wants to be whether he wants to play professional golf, I think is a big question. Whether the tour is ready to accept him as soon as January 2027, I think is also an even larger question. So that seems a little too soon. Now, is there some sort of pathway that may begin in January 2027? Sure, but I think it's going to be a longer road back than that, if he even wants to take it and the tour is ready to lay it out. That just seems a little too soon, despite, you know, the credit he might, or the asset he might be to professional golf. I think we've seen the tour sort of sail along just fine, even though it has, he has his own popularity in other platforms. The tour has sailed along just fine. I think kind of rushing him back is in January is probably too soon.
Ryan, the live event in Korea that Bryson was at was actually won by Joaquin Neiman. I think it's his eighth victory on live. But he's in a curious place if live does actually fold at the end of this season. Doesn't have any status on the PGA Tour. Didn't meet the minimum in Europe last year to keep his DP World Tour status either. He would have to settle fines and then try to play on sponsors' exemptions if that was the case. Is there any case to be made for including a guy like Joaquin Neiman in some kind of fast-track program for any tour?
I certainly think for the DP World Tour, as a player who clearly enjoys the international presence, has a pretty decorated resume at this point, at least playing internationally. He's a very curious case, Eamon, because he generally seems to enjoy playing on LIV Golf and some of the communal aspects of that experience. And that probably contributes to the fact that he has played so well on that circuit. As you mentioned, now 8 individual titles on LIV. That's 3 more than any other player, but we're still sort of struggling to contextualize what that actually means. You know, on the grand stage, on the biggest championships, he has just a single top 10 finish in his major championship career. You wonder, do major championships sort of expose the weaknesses? He's talked a couple times about needing to shore up his short game to make sure that when he's out of position, he can save par and continue momentum that way. Is he like Jon Rahm? Has been argued, you know, putting too much pressure on himself in the major championships where you're only going to be getting a couple cracks a year at some sort of history altering stakes. He is just 27 years old. He does have a pretty decorated resume either on the PGA Tour or LIV Golf. You might not want to fast track him for the PGA Tour. I think that's probably a bridge too far. For the DP World Tour, I certainly think he would fortify those tournaments, making sure that if not a full-fledged DP World Tour member, at least sprinkling some sponsor exemptions makes a ton of sense for Joaquin Neiman.
Brendan, nice to see a Century sponsoring the Torrey Pines tournament, but I'm struggling with the fact that in 2027, the Arnold Palmer Invitational will be following the Players' Championship. Am I too close to this story? Do I need to take a break, maybe a vacation? I can't sleep at night thinking that you're going to have the Players' Championship and then Bay Hill. It was perfect the way it was, kind of the run-up to the flagship event of the PGA Tour.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've seen some of these events the week after major championships. I don't know if the Players is a major, it's something significant, actually do quite well, whether it's television ratings, some drama. Harbortown Travelers have continued to soar. Like, they are stronger than ever. You know, maybe us who are really locked into those major championship weeks and working around the clock, you know, we're ready to exhale the week after. But I think we're seeing, quite frankly, and I don't know that it makes it the best event, but I think we've seen a lot of interest, like a residual interest the week after based on ratings and other metrics for these Harbortown and Travelers the last couple of years. I don't know that that makes Bay Hill a better event, though. I really have enjoyed it as a lead-in to the Players' Championship. Obviously, the Players is a mentally and physically often exhausting week to then tack on Bay Hill and what has been a very demanding setup lately, one of the hardest on the PGA Tour the last few years. I don't know that that makes it the best product. But again, they've really moved things around on the board in Florida, you know, really for the last decade or so, that I would hope it's not a long-term solution and maybe just a with the new Doral back again, maybe it's a temporary one-year bridge.
Yeah, we'll see what happens in 2028. As you often say on the Shotgun Star, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
You got it, guys.
Hill Irwin. He won Memorial back in 1983, becoming the first player in tournament history to shoot all 4 rounds under par. The win was Hale's 15th on the PGA Tour.
And 2 years later, he won another title at Muirfield Village, held off Lanny Watkins by a single shot to earn his 17th career victory on the PGA Tour. He also won Riviera Country Club with the Women's Open as this week. That was in 1998, the US Senior Open, and with that victory, he became just the seventh player in the history of the game to win both the US Open and the US Senior Open. And how is this for a Hall of Fame resume? 20 career victories on the PGA Tour, including 3 US Opens, 45 wins on the Senior Tour, 7 Senior Majors, and of course inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 1992. And it's time now for our past champions chat, and it's always a pleasure to have Hale Irwin join us here on Golf Today. Hale, it's good to see you. And there are a lot of tournaments that we could have you on here to talk about winning as a past champion. We're going to do Memorial this week. When you look back at those couple of victories, was a win just a win to you, or did it mean a little more to you at the time that it was Jack's event you were winning?
I think you make a fair analysis. It was something special. When you have the name Jack Nicklaus behind the tournament, and you can say that for Arnold, you can say that for any of the great players, but Jack in particular, who's the greatest of all time, having him being the man behind it, it made it special. It wasn't a major in the sense of the players' eyes, but it was certainly a major championship to win because of all the prestige and all that went with it.
Speaking of prestige, you also won at Riviera, an L.A. Open, a U.S. Senior Open. That's where the U.S. Women's Open will be this week. I'm from Los Angeles, so I'm biased. I want your unbiased opinion. What makes Riviera the classic in your mind that it is?
Well, you just said it's classic. There are any number of holes that they're none alike. They all have they kind of go up and down the valley there, but at the same time, they're totally different. And when you have the breeze coming off the ocean, at least when we played there, we always seemed to have a breeze. Now we're into climate change, I guess. But the breeze coming up the valley really made some of those holes play quite difficult. Now flip that, when you had the Santa Ana winds blowing, completely different golf course. So dependent upon how the wind blows, I know they've changed some of the greens a bit, and they've changed, but the routing is still pretty much the same. They've lost a few trees, they've cut a few branches. So is it the same course as it once was? No. Is it the same quality golf course as it's always been? Absolutely yes.
Hale, you're so closely identified with the U.S. Open, which is coming up in a few weeks. You won 3 times in brutal conditions, particularly that massacre at Winged Foot in 74. But it seemed back in those days that there was such a thing as a U.S. Open player, the guys who didn't overpower a golf course, but they hit every fairway and there were nails on those par putts all week long. Do you think there is such a thing anymore as a U.S. Open player?
Yeah, that's a really good question. When you see how the game has transcended, it is kind of became a game, as you suggest, one of principal driving, second shots that you had to put them in a location. And I'm maybe making some statements here that are incorrect, but I think they're pretty close versus today's game, which is bash it off the tee. It doesn't matter how deep the rough is. It doesn't matter where the hole locations are. Just hit it as far as you can. Grab one of your 8 wedges you have in your bag and hit it 200 yards. I don't relate to today's game simply because that's not the way we had to play. We played with, I won't say that our equipment was as good as it could get at the time. And you make the comment, are the players better today, or did the players make the equipment better? Which is it? How are we going to make the determination through the era? I've always liked the comparison of generations, comparing what Gene Sarazen's double eagle in 15 at Augusta National was like versus today's. It's very difficult to make because the equipment is so much different and the game is played differently now.
Well, it might be a little easier to make that comparison with the ball rollback that's coming via the USGA and R&A. Are you in favor of the ball being dialed back so you can maybe enjoy watching a little more modern golf?
Well, absolutely. I've kind of been a proponent of that for a long, long time. I think and coincidentally to that, or maybe I should say in conjunction to that, I wouldn't mind seeing the size of the driver head shrink too. What if you had, rather than 460 being the maximum, what if you had 360 or 350? Then you don't have quite the rebound exponential there. and the ball being brought back some. Now you've got a whole different formula that a player has to look at to hit the fairway. Maybe those seven irons don't go 210 yards now. Maybe they are dialed back to 165 or 70 yards. Now it presents a whole different host of problems for the players to understand. It's not just the PGA Tour. The ladies do the same thing. They hit it a long ways. You look at these college players. You look at the juniors now. The ball is just going so far, we're losing what used to be, I thought, a very interesting comparison of eras.
When you look at what Cameron Young did at the Players' Championship, Hale, where he hits a 375-yard drive on the last hole that turns out to be a ball that does conform to the future specifications, the rolled-back golf ball, do you have any fear that this war has kind of already been lost, that the action that the governing bodies might take just simply isn't going to have the impact that you might want to see?
Good point. I think, as you say, we've lost the war. I think that was lost quite a few years ago. Until the governing bodies really get it through the thought process of how are we going to protect the Rivieras of the world? How are you going to take a Muirfield Village? How are you going to take some of the great golf courses that have stood the test of time and keep them relevant just because of distance? A 7,000-yard golf course used to be something that you had to worry about. Now that is, you don't have to hit a driver any hole. You could probably drive half the greens. I just don't see where we've got to really make a major concession in what we expect out of the ball and what we expect out of the driver before we're going to see any real significant effects.
Even if the game is different today, you can't teach toughness. You had it. You're one of the best players of all time, a World Golf Hall of Fame member. You may not remember this story, Hale, but me, you, and John Feinstein, the late great writer for the Washington Post, were standing under the tree at the Masters one year, and this stream of young studs were walking by you, and I was thinking to myself, this is Hale Irwin that I'm talking with. Do these young players even know who this is? Like, do you connect with the young players? Do they reach out to you, pick your brain on what you did at the height of your power?
Simple answer is no. They have a team. Whomever constitutes that team seems to be the people they turn to. And understandable. I don't know who these kids are either. So, yeah, that's a two-way street. I wouldn't know what questions to ask them. I think you bring up a great example in Cameron and the shot he hit at 18 at the Players. How do you hit any ball 375 yards? Any ball. And if asked, Cameron's just going to say, well, you take it back and you hit it down the fairway and you go chase it. Well, there's got to be something in there. He's a very, very long, dynamic player, very strong. But at the same time, we've had those kind of players in the past. We didn't train as well as today's players do because the facilities weren't there. But there's so many things that are going into it that I think we as a golf community really have to look at it and say, how are we going to protect the game in the future? How are we going to protect the history and compare, if that is relevant, really? How are we going to compare the Jack Nicklauses and the Ben Hogans against the Scottie Schefflers and the Rory McIlroys, all these younger players? How are we going to do that? I think that is of great importance to our game because history teaches us a lot, and I'm not sure that we're willing to learn in today's game.
It would have been fascinating to see how some of the young players today would both handle and react to the conditions you played in at Winged Foot in 74 or even Inverness in 79. Wasn't exactly a picnic either. Hale, do you think in more recent years the USGA has kind of dialed back the setup for the US Open? Maybe they've lost their nerve a little bit too much because the players tend to complain a lot more?
Perhaps. I think that's a question for the USGA and the RNA, for that matter, go. I do think that there's probably some pushback simply because agronomically, do the host clubs want to put up with the conditions that we played in? And you mentioned Wingfoot, the massacre at Wingfoot. I have never in my career played a course that was more difficult that didn't have weather as a condition. That was the hardest golf course, the deepest rough, the firmest greens, the fastest greens that I've ever played on. without weather being a factor. We can talk about, you know, the Open Championship. Talk about St. Andrews, great old golf course. It's gettable, but when the wind blows, it's not gettable. So therefore, you introduce weather. But at the same time, I think we have to, as an entity, step up and say, to protect the game for history, protect the game for the future, how are we going to take all of our great golf clubs, whether they be the private courses that we belong to or the tournament courses that we all know so well, how are we going to protect that from the onslaught of the next generation of players? They're not going to get any shorter. They're going to get better. They're going to get longer. How do we do that and still keep the game relevant? That's what I concern myself with, is we've got to do something yesterday, not tomorrow.
Hale, you mentioned the Open Championship, but you'll forgive me for bringing up a painful memory. The Open's going back to Birkdale this year. You had that famous whiff on a short putt in the third round back in 1983. You ended up finishing a stroke back of Watson the following day. Do things like that linger in your mind? Because you've had so many highs and lows over the years, or do you just let it all go at this point in life?
Well, you have to let it go. It was a poor judgment on my part. As you saw, I hit it left-handed, but I had a two-sided putter. It wasn't as if anything. And when I put that club down, just to kind of hit it on the walk, if you wish, it wasn't an anger. It was just I missed. I stubbed the ground. And I immediately knew, because my heart was now in my throat, that it was a stroke. And that was on a Saturday. And you can say, well, that cost you the tournament because you finished one behind Tom Watson. Well, yeah, but there could have been other things that could have affected that even more. And I kind of counter that with saying, well, the next tee shot, I hit right in the middle of the fairway, hit one of those mounds and kicked over in a little ditch about a foot and a half wide and made a six on a par five. So what is right and what is wrong? Bad judgment should never be part of the equation, but it is. And I just didn't do the thing I needed to do very well. And that was make a two-inch putt.
Hale, before we let you go, I've always been fascinated by great athletes who are also really good at other sports. I remember visiting Jack Nicklaus's house. He wanted to watch basketball, watch his Ohio State Buckeyes, and he went outside to play tennis. You played college football. What kind of pro would you have been? Would you have been a great pro in your mind? Do you ever think about what you would have done if you had kept the helmet on?
I would probably have been that matter that gets in the cleats of the other players. Sort of like mud. I would have been tromped and romped and stomped on. You like to say, well, perhaps you had a chance, but you know, reality is I was 6 feet, 180 pounds in college. I wasn't fast. I was quick for a short distance, maybe 5 yards, but a lot of sports is within a 5 to 10 yard game. You know, basketball, perhaps track is not, but a lot of the other sports, you can succeed and still, if you keep your mind in there and use your head, you get to the point of attack and you can make a difference. But I just had this wonderful thing called golf that I could turn to, I hope, that would carry the day versus trying to get out there and get my you-know-what kicked all over the field.
Well, they might have stumped you, Hale, but we know from watching you in golf over the years, you probably would have got back up with spit in your eye and carried on the way you did in those U.S. Opens over the years. It's always great to catch up with you. Thanks for the time today.
Dylan, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Grant Boone, great to see you, my friends. We look ahead to Riviera. We talked to Beth Ann Nichols. She said that Nelly's got her schedule in order and very happy off the golf course. That's what she sees are the chief differences between 2025 in 2026. What say you?
Well, there's no question. You know, she has everything dialed in right now. She's playing great golf. She, as you mentioned, has six top twos. She plummeted into a tie for eighth at Kroger a couple of weeks ago. So that was her bad week. Cleansed the palate, if you will. And now, you know, she has a couple of weeks off. She didn't play the ShopRite LPGA Classic last week, and the entire tour had the week off before that. So rested, ready. I think what's going to be fascinating, Damon and Eamon, is just to think about the comparison to 2 years ago you just showed the graphic, and it is amazing. But consider, she had twice as many wins going into the U.S. Women's Open in 2024, and three holes into her championship, she effectively was out of it because she made a 10 on the par 3 12th, which was her third hole of the week. So weird things can happen. I can't fathom that happening again, mainly because there's you don't have a lot of water around Riviera. But even beyond that, it's just I feel like a different Nelly in every way. That was a fluke. I think if she makes, let's say, a double on that hole, I think she's probably right there, you know, toward in contention toward the end of the week. But that was a weird one, and that's kind of golf.
The last player standing last year, Grant, was, of course, Maya Stark. She was sixth in the Rolex rankings after that win. She's 23rd now. She had a little bit of a rough stretch after that win. It's kind of steadied the ship, playing unspectacular golf, but she's making a lot of weekends. What would you expect from her defending her title?
Yeah, I think Maya is a bit unpredictable right now. She's always been a little bit like the little girl with the curl. You know, when she's good, she's very good. And when she's bad, she's horrid. That's a bit of a stretch because even her terrible golf is not that terrible. But Maya admitted that she had a hard time bouncing back from, you know, reaching the summit. And by the way, that's a sentiment that a lot of professionals have in every sport. They look around and say, now what? And you have to reset your goals. Maya has had some flashes this spring that indicate that she is going to get it back together. And I think Riviera, by and large, is a ball striker's course. I don't think you necessarily see the greatest putters ever win. And I think Maya is a good putter, not a spectacular one, but she is a really good hitter of the ball.
I don't know when the term best player without a major started, whether it was Tom Kite back in the day, Corey Pavin had to go through it, O'Meara had to go through it, LPGA players as well. Gino's going through it, even at 23, and maybe it's too soon for a player who's won back-to-back CME Group Tour championships, who's been number one, has been an accomplished professional and amateur. How do you think she's dealing with the questions that are coming her way about her performance in majors not tracking with her performances elsewhere?
Well, she's trying to laugh it off, for one thing. I think, in fact, Beth Ann asked her a question a couple of weeks ago after she won the Mizuho America's Open in New Jersey, and she said something like, I knew you were going to ask that, or thanks a lot, you know. And I think that's the best you can do. You know, I mean, when Phil Mickelson was trying to win a major for the first time, you know, he just said, I think the only thing you can do is just keep putting yourself in that position. And I think Gino's too good to not win multiple major championships. I mean, we're not even talking about Gino a lot this year because of what Nelly's done. And she's won twice. You know, I mean, if not for what I still believe is the greatest closing stretch in the history of men's or women's major championship golf by Grace Kim last year at the Amundi Evian Championship, Gino would have a major and we wouldn't be talking about it. But again, it happens to the very best. And I do think the longer it goes on, the potential exists for it to become more of a thing. And with Gino this year, we've seen a few average finishes, but we've also seen the two wins as well on a difficult golf course there at Mountain Ridge in New Jersey and on a course in Thailand at her home where you have to go super deep. So Gino is a woman for all seasons, and I see no reason why she, with her ball striking, won't be up there again this week.
Grant, we just heard Hale Irwin talk about how few of the younger generation of players ever kind of seek out his advice, even when they see him in person. We've had Amy Alcott make the same point on this show about the current generation of LPGA Tour stars. She's an ambassador this week for the USGA at Riviera. She used to sneak under the fence to play the golf course as a kid. This, you would think, would be the one week of the year where some savvy players in that field would go seek out Amy Alcott and try to figure out the nuances of Riviera. How likely do you think that is to actually happen, though?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Amy still comes to the Chevron Champions dinner. She still makes her presence known. She and I talk regularly. She very much wants to be a part of, you know, of the LPGA Tour in 2026. And I know she knows many of the current crop of players. I think it's more endemic of just where we are in the world. And it happens, I think, in most every sport. I do think that, you know, we could all do a better job of venerating, of immortalizing the greats in women's golf. And I think this is the perfect week to do it. I mean, Amy won in my hometown of Nashville, Tennessee, back in 1980. It was about 150 degrees that week. And, you know, she is an absolute legend. And we're going to go this week, guys, to Riviera Country Club, which has never hosted the U.S. Women's Open, but it has hosted an LPGA founder. Babe Zaharias made the cut, the only woman to ever make a cut in a PGA Tour event. She did it at Riviera in 1945. And I hope that story gets there. I'm going to do my best to tell that story this week because it is a big part. I want these players in this generation to know. I think the Founders Cup does a great job of reminding the players where they come from. I think they get it in general. But absolutely, I would be wanting to chat up Amy Alcott and any of the other greats, Donna Capone and Judy Rankin and the others who are still there.
Well, Grant, it's always good to catch up with you. And I'm sure you join me in commending the LPGA Tour in assessing another slow play penalty last week, regardless of where the player is on the leaderboard. Everybody else should take a lead from the LPGA Tour.
How about that? Yeah, it's the second time that a player may well have lost a tournament this spring because of slow play. And it's a little different situation with USGA this week, but I know that they'll be ready.
Let that be a lesson to you, Brian Rolapp. Grant, always good to catch up. Thanks for the time.
Okay, take care, gang.
Talk today. I'll be right back.
Brent Lee. Romine, individual competition ends today. What are you watching? What are you paying attention to? These are some great, talented young players.
Well, guys, I think you have to start with Preston Stout. Any other season, Preston Stout would be the player of the year going away. Obviously, Jackson Koivun winning six times this spring. That has all but made these player of the year races moot. But Stout has been an incredible player over the past three seasons, three-time Big 12 individual champion. Of course, last week when we released that Battle of the Cowboys YouTube match, he dominated Victor Hovland, a three-time European Ryder Cupper, beat him 4-3, was 5-up through 7 holes on him. And if Preston Stout ever plays the Open Championship, guys, the British press are going to have a field day, because back when he was in junior golf, he used to skip big tournaments that overlapped with hunting season. We'll see if he can track down an individual title, but going to need to hold off some pretty good stories, one of those being William Jennings from Alabama playing as an individual this week. You go back two springs ago, William Jennings was playing in just his second event as a freshman. He shot 92 in the first round and was on his way to not breaking 90 again when Coach Jay Sewall took the scorecard out of his hands, withdrew him, and he told him that day, "I can't wait until those tears turn into smiles." We'll see if that'll be the case today. And one more great story for you guys. Kihei Akina, if you're looking for a player to make a run, he's best friends with AJ DeBanza on the BYU basketball team. Kihei's been the best freshman for BYU in the nation on the golf course, also one of 7 siblings. So I would hate to see what the grocery bill is for the Akina family.
Let's turn our attention to the team competition, Brantley. Which teams are playing their way in or out of contention today?
Yeah, so it's interesting because it seems like every year those teams that could get that early wave of tee times, teeing off about an hour, hour 10, 20 before the teams in the afternoon, they get an advantage. Like we saw last week with Eastern Michigan and Pepperdine both playing their way into match play on the women's side. And, you know, I'm looking below and I see 3 top 10 teams in the country in Florida, LSU, in Tennessee. You know, these are heavyweights from the SEC, and they're already making runs right now, and they're making the turn, and this wind is picking up, and a lot of those teams have momentum as well. And on the flip side, Arizona still has a lot of golf to play. UCLA still a lot of golf to play. And if we're thinking about which team has the most momentum, it might be LSU, who's just a day removed from shooting an 18 under par score to go from 27th and already booking flights home to jumping all the way into 12th. And going into today, a record fewest margin between 8th and 15th, just three shots. It's going to be absolutely close, and there's going to be a lot of fireworks and chaos as we get down, you know, once the broadcast comes on and we get toward the end to see which teams will qualify for that Elite Eight.
So Hale Irwin was a dominator. How great to talk to the World Golf Hall of Famer today.
It was, and I kind of hope that we see a U.S. Open venue at Shinnecock in a couple of weeks that really harkens back to the glory days of the U.S. Open, the Hale Irwin era. I mean, he talked about the massacre at Winged Foot in 74. Inverness in 79 was brutal. It wasn't much fun at Medina when he won in 1990 at the age of 45 as well. And people forget that he actually went out on one on tour again the very next week as well in the Buick back then. So I hope the USGA doesn't lose its nerve and does actually tighten the thumb screws, because there is a little history on this golf course. There's been controversy around the course setup the last two times they've been at Shinnecock. I hope we see a bit of brutality out there. We saw a little bit at Oakmont last year, but a lot of that was weather influence as well. A couple of previous Opens were non-traditional open courses in terms of setup at Pinehurst and LACC for the 2 years before that. I want to see that thumb screws tightened.
Driving it straight should matter. Didn't you kind of detect that? He was saying, listen, I mean, the modern game's just about hit it as far as you can, no matter where it goes. That's not Hale Irwin's era of golf.
No, it absolutely isn't. And I don't think it's going to be what we're going to see at Shinnecock Hills either.
We'll see what the pros can handle at the U.S. Open.